Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Jude Rogers. If you're old enough to remember Cold War Mark I, as I am, having been a child of the nuclear war-obsessed 1980s, you'll remember the idea of civil defence. This involved plans to protect people in emergency situations in the face of man-made disasters. And no, it wasn't just about building shelters out of mattresses in your living room, protect and survive style, while the siren from the beginning of Frankie Goes to Hollywood's Two Tribes blared in your ears. It was also about the principles of disaster prevention and mitigation, response and recovery, and it required people to imagine what a nuclear war would be like and how people could survive it. While the atomic threat still looms large in our lives, another man-made disaster is just as pressing, climate change. But how do we imagine what that will be like and how we can survive that? Can ideas from civil defence in the mid to late 20th century help us to navigate our equally terrifying present? To tell us more, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Matthew Grant, a senior lecturer in history at the University of Essex, a Cold War historian, and author of the forthcoming book, The Cold War and the Remaking of British Citizenship. Thanks for joining us today, Matthew, in our rather appropriately named bunker. You know, I want to ask you what you think of its suitability for any future man-made disasters, but I don't think it'd be that great. Anyway, welcome.
Thank you.
So you've read so much, newspapers and books plumb the depths of so much research about people's responses to the idea of nuclear war and how people try to imagine, as you say, the unimaginable. Could you summarise for us what these ideas were like straight after World War II and what happened in 1954, which changed people's ideas?
Just after the Second World War, I think people were confronted by this completely new weapon, the atomic bomb. They'd read the newspapers, heard the radio reports about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that sense that these bombs ended the war, killed countless people. So I think people had to try and imagine what that would be, what would it be like if there was a third world war. I think people really struggled to do that. And I think people had really a couple of ways of imagining it. One was to think, oh my God, if there's a war, the world's going to end. And that was very, very common. There were lots of sort of stories in newspapers and things which emphasised it in that way. The other way of looking at it would be to say, well, actually, it can be coped with. And for people in Britain after the Second World War, the main reason they thought about that was actually by thinking about the bombs that they'd lived with through the Second World War. And so actually, if you were in the middle of London in 1946, 47, you would see the physical scars of that war all around you. And I think it was very hard for people thinking about what a future war would look like without applying it to their lived experience of what just occurred. And so when the government said to people, well, actually, we can cope with this, we can minimise casualties, we can have civil defence and we can rescue people, lots of people thought, yeah, we can do that. And I think there's a different aspect as well with the British national story, which is familiar to us all and still has a great deal of political import of Britain standing alone in the Second World War and resisting Hitler, really fed into it. Because there were lots of people like, we fought Hitler, we can fight the atomic bomb. It's like, they're not quite the same thing. And I think, so there's loads of bits like that. And I think part of it as well is that the British experience of the Second World War was, you know, and bombing was very different from, say, the German experience. You know, the scale of enemy, bombing attacks on Germany were significantly heavier than Britain ever experienced. So there's a whole weird imaginative process that goes on.
You've written fascinatingly about this British spirit and this coming together of the idea of civil defence and how it will work. But in 1954, then there's the, then you have the tests that, you know, travel around the world. And again, you write about this in terms of the news broadcasts and the way people, you know, kind of realise, you know, the potential of the bomb.
Yeah, in 1954, when the Americans test the hydrogen bomb, the thermonuclear weapon in Bikini Atoll, and then the radioactive fallout infects the Japanese fishermen and becomes a big story.
This is like 82 miles away or something.
Out of the blast, downwind. Yeah. And I think that's when it becomes clear, because the hydrogen bomb had been developed over previous few years, but it was that test, really, that made people realise that this is a bomb that could destroy an entire city. And there was a famous news conference in New York, which was reported around the world, where they were asked, how big could this bomb be? And he said, we could destroy the whole of the New York City metropolitan area, one bomb. And so any sense that you might have had that this could be survived, that, you know, men and women in uniform could dig you out of some rubble and give you a hot cup of cocoa and everything would be okay, is gone. And I think that obviously was immensely shocking for lots of people. And that sense that, not only that, so if you live in a big urban area, then you have no hope of survival. But more than that, if you lived in the rural countryside, you would equally be in danger because of radioactive fallout. Mm. And I mean, as the 50s go on, people begin to realise that there's nowhere in Britain that's safe. You're either, you know, in Britain, one of the most highly urbanised countries in the world, you're in cities. If you're out of cities, well, if you're in the eastern half of the country, outside of cities, you're probably near a big airbase that's also a target area. Or you're in a rural area which may... So basically, unless you live in sort of the Highlands or the sort of, or Mid Wales, there's a sense that there's nowhere you're going
to
be.
I have to say, safe. I live in Mid Wales. I live five miles from the SES base, so we're in deep trouble.
That's it. There's nowhere that's not a target area, because if there's no people there, there's a military installation.
So I find it fascinating thinking of this in relation to, you know, us now imagining the unimaginable of climate change. How do you think we are doing that in 2023?
I think it's really, really hard. I think people are aware that there is a danger waiting us. I think there's the scientific evidence and the expert advice we all get that there's dangers, and we can kind of understand that. But I think if you, when you see in the newspapers and, you know, the 2 degree target, etc., I think it's very hard to then think what that might mean for us in our everyday life, in terms of more extreme weather and so on, rising tides. But what does that mean in terms of that individual change? Mm. I mean, it's hard for us to imagine what the rising sea levels actually look like for real people. And so I think that's one part of it. The other part of it, I think, is it's really hard, I think, for some people to think that what they would do as an individual might make what difference that makes. You know, I think people, you know, think, well, I can recycle, I can cut down on my meat, and so all these things that, you know, and cut down my air travel, all the things we should be doing and we need to be doing. But then there's, I think, a lot of people have the nagging bit of my doubt, but when people in Texas are just carrying on or increasing the things, then that makes no difference.
What parallels, can we draw between, you know, the rise of interest in civil defence, those early days, after the Second World War, which obviously came backwards and forwards over the years, you know, with what's going on now?
I think that sense of people being able to look around them and see the real difference that some things can make. I think, you know, with civil defence, the hard thing that people who cared about civil defence had, especially after 1954, was convincing people that they might make a little bit of a difference on the very edge. So civil defence argued that, yes, obviously if you're in the middle of London, there's much less chance of survival. But if you're in, you know, Romford or Croydon, on the edge of that blast zone, someone, you might be able to be saved. And I think that sense of individuals being able to see the differences, I think, can make a difference. You know, so for example, if you're in London, trying to recognise that the reason the Thames Barrier exists is to protect against rising tides, or tidal surges, as it were. And I think that sense of, you know, and the things the Environment Agency might try and do. And I think there's that sense of connection with the natural world a bit, I think, really, really helps. And that sense that individuals can do something that's not just despairing. Because I think the other big parallel of the Cold War is that individuals didn't feel they could do much. I mean, you could protest against nuclear weapons, but I think, which people obviously did. But I think even in the 1980s, there was a worry that actually the big decisions are obviously being made in Moscow and Washington, and if you're protesting in London or Greenham Common, then actually that's got a limited utility. And it's really noticeable that when the protests in Britain were at their height were at moments when big decisions were being made. Mm. So in the early 60s and late 50s, it was when Britain was deciding how their nuclear deterrent would operate. In Britain in the 80s, it was about cruise missiles and things like that. So actually real things that people felt they could make a difference about sparked these big global things. And I think now people have to have a sense of what they can do.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
In some ways, you know, it's useful to think about, obviously, the lessons of history and how these can be applied. And I find it interesting that your ideas of imagining the future maybe say a lot about the time you grew up as well. So you're about the same age as me, so mid-40s. You grew up in the 80s when the bomb was just this insidious part of popular culture. I've written about the film Threads and the film Where the Wind Blows, obviously based on Raymond Briggs' graphic novel. There's this idea of nuclear war kind of infiltrating pop culture and being explored in pop culture, whether it be for black comedy or in the case of Threads, to try and tell people this is what it's going to be like and try and affect, you know, politicians and policy. It's interesting thinking of that in relation to some of the things that are going on today. I was thinking about the film Don't Look Up, about climate change, the various, you know, Hollywood disaster blockbusters. Mm-hmm. How important do you think, you know, storytelling is to, you know, teach people about, you know, the threats that are facing us?
I think it's absolutely central, because I think we can only construct a sense of the future from the narratives that are around us. And I think what films such as Threads did so well was to really articulate and try and imagine a future that was horrific and what it would be. Because I think in the Cold War, there was a big emphasis, there was protest to try and stop a war ever happening. You know, there was a binary question between whether there had to be peace, and if there was a war, that was it, everyone ended. And actually what Threads was amazing at was arguing, no, actually, if this happens, it's not going to be the end, and that's worse. Mm. You know, and that's the true horror of Threads, isn't it? It's actually that you're not going to die, that you might survive.
Yeah, the bomb goes off like 45 minutes into the film, and then the film goes on forever.
Forever, about how horrific it is. And I think the key thing is to have really good stories and really convincing stories that tell that, and that don't just fall back on what can be a sort of disaster trope. Because I think actually you can make a sort of generic thing about, oh, there's a terrible disaster, don't worry, the hero reverts it, and then say, and actually you can make that about the nuclear future, you can make that about climate change, you can make it about asteroids, you can make it about anything you want, but actually to really think about this idea of what the future would look like when this, if climate change, you know, continues and the landscape shifts so much, that's the problem.
So civil defence was, as you said, was seen as being about patriotism, community spirit after the Second World War, as you said. But it became something to be mocked as well, didn't it? It was about government, and I'm quoting you here, presenting an impression of preparedness in order to convince the public that they would be able to save lives in a nuclear war and stiffen resolve to face any international crisis. You know, famously, the, you know, well-known protect and survive leaflets and television adverts were leaked. They were shown on Panorama on television. You know, they got used in, as I mentioned earlier, kind of amazing remixes of Frankie Goes to Hollywood songs. But there was this idea that any idea of civil defence was ridiculous. Where do you think the British public is now with, you know, thinking about how the government are responding to climate change or directing us to think about climate change?
I'm not sure the public would have a great deal of trust in any sense of the government having a deep-seated, long-term plan. And I think at the moment, the government gets really caught between loads of competing policy agendas, and I think really struggles to focus on the future. I mean, perhaps the most complex one is nuclear power, which some people would argue is one of the ways that nations can try and deliver a sort of energy sources that are carbon free. Obviously, the idea that they are sustainable or environmentally friendly is, of course, is meant to be controversial, because of course they're neither of those things. And I think there's a real struggle to imagine to think about them in that sense. Mm. At the same time, you've got the government, I think, is absolutely in thrall really to groups that, well, essentially we call them NIMBYs. You know, the idea that who do not want wind farms near them, do not want these big infrastructure projects that can actually help deliver clean energy, because they're, it spoils the view. Well, you know, if things carry on, you're not going to have a view.
Yes.
So I think there is that, and I think that's really difficult. And I think there's so many different things that get caught up. You know, I think we'd all probably like to see more renewable, more green energy, more sustainable transport infrastructure. But then just saying, well, that means we should have more nuclear power stations, more onshore wind farms and HS2, is a policy leap. There's lots of other things going on.
And there's also more of a drive for consultation with the public in, you know, when these initiatives, directives are being rolled out. And, you know, people quite often think about, yeah, as you say, their backyards rather than the, you know, longer term issues. It's something that people have to, you know, work with and fight against quite often. You know, you mentioned how, the signs of war, like bomb sites, you know, were obviously in Britain for, you know, quite a long time after the Second World War, and they could have reminded people of war and the survival of war. But what do you think our equivalents are today in relation to climate change?
I think I suppose a lot of these sorts of sites are hidden, but we do see them. I mean, like big landfill sites and things like that. I can't remember exactly what it is, but if you ever drive down the M4, there's a bit where you come over here and there's this huge landfill site, and you just see all these seagulls piling on it. And that sense of resources being sort of piled into that, I think you do see these sort of scarred areas. And I think it's really noticeable as well in cities. I think cities have got so much better for that, and there seems to be a more coherent use of space in some cities. And I think that's one of the answers as well, I think, in terms of housing and in terms of people being able to, live more sustainably. Mm. But I suppose, you know, but then again, there's just these aspects of life that I suppose we see every day and we don't really think of, motorways, airports that are just, that are just there, and we don't, and they're just an ordinary part of life.
And obviously I'd love to say, so what's the answer? And you know, kind of obviously that's not something for you, it's for the policy makers on a global scale to talk about this. Obviously there are connections between, you know, the atomic threat and, you know, kind of climate change, you know, in that sense as well, you know, same countries that, you know, there are concerns about, et cetera, et cetera. In this world where the climate crisis and the atomic threat are being thought about in relation to, you know, some of the same world powers, you know, how has that made you think about your work, you know, particularly with how relevant some of it is to our present situation?
It's a tricky one because I'm a historian. For me, it's about this link and how we can try and get people to think about the world around them, to think about changes that they might make in their own lives or their local communities that might give them a more of a sense of a sustainable future. Now that's on the one hand can be individual recycling more or whatever, you know. But actually, I was thinking more people who live in say a coastal area, being aware of the world around them. So, for example, if you go to pretty much anywhere in the east coast of Britain, there'd be a massive concrete seawall that was built in the last 70 years, from the 50s onwards. And that's designed to protect them. And I think that's that realisation that that's not a natural landscape. It's a man-made landscape that's designed to defend things. And I think that sense of realising that that's still very fragile and that there's work to go that has to go on there. And one of the things I think is interesting, I think the conversation is somewhere like the Netherlands might be quite different, when obviously, you know, those sea defences protect most of the country.
Yeah.
If you look at Britain and the rest of Northern Europe as a place that's actually very closely connected across that sea, there might be a slightly different way of thinking about it.
So obviously there are movements now like, you know, Extinction Rebellion that, you know, have clear parallels with protest movements in the past. You know, there may be assumptions that there are similar kinds of people who, you know, willing to CND who are now in that. Not always, you know, completely correctly. You know, I wondered if there were any lessons that you've learned through your work that could, you know, help inform the work of, you know, people who are environmental campaign groups or protesters.
I suppose, ironically, that they're the people who are most likely to be really engaged and understand the threats facing people who are. And I think there's the links between, say, Extinction Rebellion and people like CND are that activism and an attempt to convince others is a way of coping with the future, a coping with that uncertainty. It's a way of you becoming not master of the situation, but someone who is actually not letting this situation happen to you is activism in its most literal sense. And also both CND and Extinction Rebellion are actually quite broad-based groups that bring a lot of different people together who might not typically be involved. I would have probably encouraged those organisations to think about how other people think about the future, if you know what I mean. Because I think just sometimes just giving people the information isn't enough. There's so many competing claims about expert advice, which I think is very hard for people to, you know, we're not, most people are not experts on this. Therefore, it's very hard to filter out what is the most important thing. And everyone, I think, filters out certain things that suits their own lifestyle and that choices. So I think that's really, really hard. But I think there's such a lack of trust in the idea that big infrastructure projects can help the environment and aren't, and that rather than the environment just being used as a sort of extra justification for a massive sort of political or industrial project. I think that's the problem, isn't it? Is that it's very easy for people to say, oh, we're going to do all the multi-billion pound building projects, it's going to tear up huge parts of the country, but it's for the environment.
Yeah. Trust in government is such a massive part of this, obviously. Trust in national government, regional government, local government, which is probably a subject for a completely different podcast. Yeah. Thank you so much, Matthew, for being here in The Bunker today.
Very welcome.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe. Give us reviews on your favourite podcast app and spread the word by telling your friends. You can also support The Bunker on Patreon for as little as £3 per month. Search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out how making a small contribution gets you lovely merchandise plus early editions of the podcast and more. Thanks for listening.
The Bunker Daily was written and presented by Jude Rogers. The producer was Kasia Tomaszewicz, with audio production by me, Jade Bailey. The lead producer is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.